Good evening, everybody. Welcome. Pleasure to be here with you tonight. We're really excited to talk to you about our respiratory portfolio. I want to start, first I'll introduce myself. I'm Colleen Proctor with AstraZeneca Investor Relations, and I want to introduce the panel of people that we have with us tonight. So we have James Ward-Lilly, who's the head of our respiratory inflammation and autoimmunity from a commercial perspective. Bing Yao, who is the head of MedImmune, RIA for the large molecules. We have Martin Cron, who is the head of our RIA small molecules. Bill Mezzanotte, who is the head of RIA from a late stage development perspective. And last but certainly not least is Chuck Bramlage, who is the president and CEO of Pearl Therapeutics. So we're going to do a quick presentation for you where we'll talk about a summary of the portfolio, and then Bing Yao is going to get into some of the details about what we've presented at ATS, and then we're going to have a Q&A session where we bring the panel up front. So I'm going to turn it over to James Ward-Lilly.
Thanks, Colleen. Thank you all. It's great to see you all here today, and it's great to be at the ATS. I think the ATS is a very important time and really a milestone for the respiratory, autoimmune, and inflammation portfolio and franchise for AstraZeneca. And it marks a milestone in terms of the progression of our pipeline, which we're excited about. There's been a lot of discussion here over the last few days about increasing focus and targeted therapies, better understanding of personalized healthcare, and that applies in all segments, in mild, moderate, and severe disease. And that's where we believe, with AstraZeneca, we have the opportunity to reestablish an industry leadership position in COPD, in asthma, and IPF, and apply that understanding, and perhaps a unique understanding in terms of personalization of medicine in all of our therapeutic approaches. And before I get into the details of our plan, as I said, RIA really has four legs of our plan. First is its existing portfolio. As you know very well, Symbicort and Pulmicort are on the market today and doing extremely well. Secondly, we're excited about the new inhaled element of our portfolio brought to us through the acquisition of the Pearl Therapeutics company, and that's bringing us a series of new opportunities in combination therapy. Thirdly, our biologics portfolio, and that's primarily going to be the focus for today's session, and in particular, we're going to focus on benralizumab, tralokinumab, and also talk briefly about the TSLP, where there's been an interesting new paper presented today in the New England Journal of Medicine. And then finally, the fourth leg of our strategy is the autoimmune portfolio. That's not going to be the focus, but as you know, we've recently made some press releases and announced good progress in the RA sector with mavrilumumab and also in the SLE segment with sifalimumab. The focus, as I said, is on respiratory leadership. And I think, you know, I'd simplify this in terms of why do we think we can be leaders? First of all, it's about having the right molecules, and we believe we do have the right molecules, whether it's with budesonide and formoterol, which we believe in terms of their efficacy and safety profiles are the ideal molecules in the market today. But also, we've got great molecules for the future as well, and we'll turn to that in a moment. Secondly, it's about right combinations. And as I said, being able to formulate these products and put them into combination, whether it's dual combinations or triple combinations, we see a very exciting and bright future. And then finally, it's the right devices. And again, we have today a series of devices, both the turbohaler in the DPI and also the MDI. And again, that's an important point of differentiation, particularly when it comes to our LABA/LAMA franchise, which will be the first and only MDI formulation coming into the market in the first instance. So when we talk about the respiratory franchise, you know, we're excited for those reasons, and we see a real opportunity for this franchise to contribute significantly to AstraZeneca's growth. We've identified three core therapeutic areas: oncology, cardiovascular metabolism, and respiratory and autoimmune. And the data we're starting to see now, I think, will give you increasing confidence that we have a real ability to deliver on the pipeline progress and the targets which we set out a couple of weeks ago in our updated guidance. And in spite of many years of therapy, the market remains one where there is high levels of unmet medical need, partly driven by low diagnosis and treatment, partly driven by lack of adherence and effective management, partly driven by the severity of the disease. And you can clearly see here in this chart, and this is the G7 markets only, that around 11 million patients remain poorly controlled in the asthma segment, and around 8 million patients remain poorly controlled in the more severe segments in COPD. In total, there's about 3.5 million patients who remain severe in asthma and COPD despite good compliance. So in spite of having compliant therapy, you see 1.7 million patients in the severe setting still needing to use and have to use additional therapies, and 1.8 million in the severe setting despite good compliance with COPD. So there remains a significant opportunity, again, across our portfolio in mild, moderate, and severe. And again, we're going to focus on severe asthma and moderate to severe COPD in our data presentation in a moment. As I said before, we are excited and we believe we can be an industry leader through our unique inhaled therapies with Symbicort, a differentiated inhaled range, and developing new devices and innovative product offerings, helping patients to adhere to their products more effectively. Secondly, a series of innovative targeted therapies. And again, we believe with our portfolio and our research and discovery efforts, we have an ability to have a unique insight in terms of choosing and identifying, targeting the right patients at the right stage and apply a portfolio approach in delivering solutions for those patients. And then finally, our goal is not just treatment of symptoms, but fundamentally, we are working with the profession, clinicians and scientists are looking at disease transformation. How can we fundamentally change the progression of this disease or stop the development of this disease? Because we believe it's not just symptomatic treatment that's going to be of value, and that is going to be of huge value to patients and also, of course, to payers. And before we turn to the biologics data, which, of course, is very exciting and an amount of it has been presented here at ATS, I do just want to spend a moment stressing why we see there is continued further opportunity with our inhaled portfolio. We have a strong franchise of around $4.5 billion worth of sales continuing to grow with Symbicort and Pulmicort, and we believe there's continued strong growth potential in both the US, in the emerging markets, and in Japan, and with China in particular. And with Symbicort, with a combination of formoterol and budesonide, the speed of the onset, the smart dosing regimen, allows us to further think about innovating with that product. And looking now, as we are with the Sigma program, which is a PRN program, which we're about to start recruiting in the next couple of months, moving into an even earlier setting, the step two setting within asthma. If we go to COPD, as you know, we're about to move forward, and we are moving forward very well with the recruitment of the LABA-LAMA phase 3 program. We've completed enrollment of there, and we expect to close that program before the end of this year, and we should be submitting on target by the middle of next year. We also said in our quarter one update, we've made great progress with our triple therapy. There's been a lot of data here at this meeting about the potential use of triple therapy, particularly in the more severe setting in COPD, where exacerbations is an important challenge. So we see there's a unique position for Symbicort continuing in asthma and developing that, but also Symbicort short-term or medium-term with the exacerbating patient in COPD. A clear positioning for the LABA-LAMA, a clear positioning for the LABA-ICS, and then further a clear positioning for the more severe patient with the triple therapy. And again, it's this unique portfolio approach in inhaled setting, which we think really gives the opportunity for AstraZeneca to show leadership. I think one last moment on this slide, I'd stress the potential further combinations we see. And again, this is the opportunity we have with unique dose conformity and the ability to put the combinations of drugs together, whether it's existing drugs or existing drugs with novels or novels on the Pearl platform, doubles or triples or even more than that. And we have also said we're moving forward with a triple program in asthma. So that's the inhaled portfolio. Clearly, we're very excited about the progress we're making in the pipeline. We have three assets today in phase 3, as you can see on this slide. We've started our program and recruiting in asthma with benralizumab. We have PT003, the LABA-LAMA, as I said. I gave you the details of that a moment ago. And we also have PT001. That's the LAMA program, which comes out of the LABA-LAMA program and effectively is a further phase 3 asset. We look forward to giving you the details, announcing in the near future tranquilizumab's first entry and first patient recruited and dosed. As you said, we have made the commitment and are starting that program with Trallo. So tranquilizumab will be moving into the asthma. That will be a fourth asset in phase three. And then, of course, we also have announced and we're starting the program for benralizumab in COPD. So we can expect to see that also moving into phase three in the very near future. As I said before, we're accelerating the program with the triple. The triple is now in phase two, as you can see, PT010. That program is moving extremely well. We hadn't dosed with and hadn't formulated with the ICS, budesonide, last year. That program, phase one, was started in Q4, completed early in Q1. We're now in phase two, and we expect to be entering into Q3 by the middle of next, sorry, into phase three by the middle of next year. So very significant acceleration in our pipeline, very significant acceleration and breadth of portfolio pipeline progress in the inhaled portfolio and also in the biologics. And I'll hand over to Bing now to go into the details, the data on benralizumab, tralokinumab, and on the TSLP. Bing.
Thank you, James. So it's a real pleasure to be here to discuss the promising new data we shared at ATS. It's good to see so many familiar faces to talk to you again. As James showed you, we believe that we have one of the most comprehensive portfolio in the respiratory disease areas. But more importantly, we're using personalized healthcare approach targeting distinct patient subsets. Those therapies have the potential to transform disease management from what now it is step therapy to personalized healthcare. I hear very often in this meeting, precision therapy. It underscores the importance of targeted therapy, targeting the right drug to the right patient population. So I'm going to highlight three new molecular entities for you today. We'll start with benralizumab. Benralizumab is currently in phase three development for a subset of the severe uncontrolled asthma. We have a diagnostics targeting eosinophilic asthma. Eosinophilic asthma represents nearly half of the total severe uncontrolled asthmatics. And we and others found that eosinophil cell counts is associated with the disease severity. The higher you have the eosinophils in your peripheral blood, the more severe the disease, the more likely the patient is to experience exacerbation. Now I want to draw your attention to your left. That's how benralizumab works. For those of you online, that's slide number 11. Benralizumab has a direct impact on eosinophils. It does so by binding to the interleukin-5 receptor on the surface and leads to the depletion of this target cell. The efficacy of benralizumab is enhanced. It's engineered to remove the sugar residues from the FC region. Now, on slide number 12. Based on the profile from several clinical studies, we believe that benralizumab has a potential to be best in disease for severe uncontrolled asthma. It has a unique MOA. It is the first and only anti-IL-5 receptor currently in clinical study. This molecule can potently deplete eosinophils, peripheral, but also deplete eosinophils from the airway mucosa and sputum. In terms of efficacy, we shared that at ATS here. Benralizumab not only reduced exacerbation, but also improved lung function as measured by FEV1. It also improved asthma control, ACQ6. This is where we differentiated from our competitor's molecule. Achieved exacerbation reduction and secondaries. Dosing, we're the only one testing every 8-week dosing. This is given by sub-Q and one injection. Now I would like to go into a little bit more details of the data. This is on slide number 13. First, we're looking at the pharmacodynamic impact of benralizumab, looking at the eosinophil depletion. All three doses, 2, 20, and 100, depleted eosinophils to very low level, very fast, after the first dose. And also the depletion was maintained if you look at the 20 milligram and 100 milligram. Those are the purple line and the yellow line. The last dose was given at week 40. It gradually returned to normal after the last dose, in particular with a lower dose. Therefore, the depletion is potent, but also reversible. Now, looking at the primary endpoint with a reduction of exacerbation. So this is based on index prediction of the eosinophilic asthma versus non-eosinophilic asthma. I want to draw your attention to the yellow bar here. 100 milligram reduced asthma exacerbation by 41% in the eosinophilic asthma patient population. In the non-eosinophilic patient population, that's on your right, 22% reduction. Because of the MOA, which is the depleted eosinophils, we pre-specified subgroups for analysis, and in particular, pre-specified analysis based on the baseline eosinophil cell levels, 200, 300, and 400. If you look in the middle, the 300, 20 milligram dose and 100 milligram dose reduced exacerbation by 57%, 43%. As the baseline eosinophil gets higher, 400, now we see very, very large reduction. Now it goes to 57 to 70% reduction of the exacerbation. What's looking to going forward in our phase 3 development, we're going to use a straightforward test, which is a peripheral blood eosinophils. It's a simple blood test. Now looking at the non-function improvement, that's on your slide number 16, you can see all three doses improved non-function as measured by FEV1. It appears to be a trend. For example, once the baseline eosinophil gets higher, there's more improvement with the bevacizumab. Those are significant and marked improvement of non-function. We also look at the ACQ6. So this is the asthma control on your slide number 17. This is a composite questionnaire comprising symptoms and activity limitation. If you have a decrease of 0.5, that is minimally clinically important differences. And ACQ is used to predict the disease severity. Over 1.5 means patients have severe disease. This is a pre-specified analysis. On your right, that's patients with baseline eosinophils of over 300. You see meaningful differences, improvement of asthma control with the 20 milligram and 100 milligram dose in the patients with elevated eosinophils. Data is promising and encouraging. We're currently now in phase 3 development for severe uncontrolled asthma. Phase 3 is ongoing and is on track to complete by the first quarter of 2016. There are two pivotal studies. In terms of patient population, that's very similar to our phase 2b clinical study, severe uncontrolled patient population on ICS and LABA. In terms of patient population, we pre-specified a cutoff for eosinophils, but also testing a range so to see which patient population will best respond to our therapy. Primary endpoints and secondary endpoints remain to be the same as in our phase 2b clinical study. Bevacizumab, moving on to slide number 19, has also been tested in COPD. So this is where we're doing new science. Traditionally, people think COPD is mediated by neutrophils, but increasing evidence and also our own work suggested up to 1/3 of the COPD patients have elevated eosinophils in their peripheral blood. And importantly, the elevated eosinophils appears to associate with increased acute exacerbation of COPD. Now we have this potent molecule that can deplete eosinophils. So we tested bevacizumab in the subset of COPD patient population in a phase 2A clinical study. Now slide number 20 summarizes the results from our phase 2A clinical study. Similar to the bevacizumab in asthma, we found that bevacizumab can potently deplete the target cells in those patient population, same dosing regimen. In terms of efficacy, we saw marked improvement in terms of non-function FEV1. For the primary endpoint of exacerbation reduction in the protocol-defined population, we did not meet the primary endpoint in the exacerbation reduction. However, we did see a trend toward reduction of exacerbation in patients with elevated eosinophils. In this patient population, we also see improvement in the health-related quality of life improvement and also symptom scores improvement. Dosing, very similar to bevacizumab, we test Q8-week dosing regimen. Going to get into a little bit more details of the data. Then slide number 21. On left shows you the exacerbation reduction in all comers. There's no differences between placebo and the treated group. On your right side, now if you look at the patients, these are pre-specified with more than 200 cells or 300 cells. Now you see a trend toward a reduction in the COPD exacerbation. Looking at lung function improvement, that's FEV1, slide number 22. This is in the protocol-defined population. It's consistent with the COPD patients. If you observe them for 1 year, you will see the lung function decline. So that's a gray line you saw there. Bevacizumab-treated patients now have an improvement in terms of FEV1. The mean improvement is about 130 mL. The two points I want to make here, one is it happened real fast after the very first visit at week 4. And secondly, the improvement is sustained. The last dose was given week 48. Now, that's the improvement at the 56 week, goes to 68 week, and even week 80. Sustained improvement of lung function. But what's more impressive here is, now in the pre-specified analysis, looking at the patients with elevated eosinophils, more than 200 or 300 here, all the gray bar are the patients treated with a placebo. Bevacizumab treated patients at 200, at baseline eosinophil of over 200. Now we saw over 200 mL differences. With 300, that's also over 200 mL. I want to see this is the first biologic demonstrating improvement in terms of lung function in COPD patients, and also the first biologic tested in those eosinophilic COPD patient population. And over half of the patients here are actually on triple therapies. So that's why it makes that data quite impressive and meaningful. Now, if you look at the same population, patients with elevated eosinophils on health-related quality of life. That's as measured by St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire. If you look at the tech total score, over 200 or 300, now see an improvement. Improvement of 4 points will be clinically meaningful. That's over that. And particularly, if you look at the symptom scores, so there are over 10 points improvement in terms of symptom scores. Once you put all this together, I think data is encouraging. And also, along with our proof of concept study data in asthma, we are taking this molecule into phase 3. Phase 3 is planned to start for the third quarter of this year. There'll be two pivotal studies. It'll be a moderate to severe COPD patient population, similar to the ones in our phase 2A clinical study. And clearly, we are going to be testing this compound in patients with elevated eosinophils. We're going to pre-specify a cutoff, but also we're testing a range to determine what patient population would better respond to our therapy. Primary and secondary are the same as in our phase 2A clinical study. So moving on from bevacizumab to a second new molecular entity, that's tralokinumab. We also share the data in this conference. Tralokinumab is for severe uncontrolled asthma. It has potential for a different patient subset. Bevacizumab for eosinophilic asthma. This one has a potential for a Th2 asthma. The target is interleukin-13. If you look at your left, interleukin-13 is a central mediator in the pathogenesis of asthma, involving many aspects of the disease pathogenesis. Notably, mucus hypersecretion directly affect airway smooth muscles, including induced constriction, and also function of fibroblasts, induced fibrosis. It's a highly validated target. There are downstream markers identified which can be used to predict the response to anti-IL-13 pathway. I also would like to mention that we also have a phase two study in IPF that is ongoing. So going to phase 2B study a few years back, we had the hypothesis anti-IL-13 would have enhanced efficacy in only a subset of patient population where the IL-13 pathway is active. Therefore, we spent our research efforts to identify the downstream biomarkers that can predict the response. So here are some of the research experiments looking at the genes that are highly upregulated by IL-13. So we identified pyrosin, as others did, but also a novel biomarker, DPP4, as induced by IL-13. We incorporated those into our phase 2b data analysis, pre-specified. Looking at the primary endpoint, that's asthma exacerbation reduction. In this trial, we enrolled all comers, but we specified several subgroups based on the clinical phenotype as well as a biomarker. I want to draw your attention to your right side. If you look at the intent to treat population, we have a small reduction of asthma exacerbation, 7%, not significant. But in the pre-specified subgroups, in particular, I want to draw your attention to the 12% reversibility. Now we saw a trend toward a reduction, 30%, 34% reduction in terms of asthma exacerbation. Also, there are enhanced reduction in other subgroups, including pyrosin high, DPP4 high, and also the patients who are not on oral corticosteroids. We further analyzed those groups, particularly combining some of the biomarkers. This is on the slide number 29. If you look at the blue bar on your left, so these are the patients who are reversible, who are not on oral corticosteroids. I want to mention that this is the population very similar to the population lebrikizumab tested in their phase 2 clinical study. Now, even without the biomarker, we saw 44% reduction in asthma exacerbation. Biomarkers such as pyrosin enhanced the efficacy, now 67% reduction with a caveat of the smaller sample size with the DPP4, 57% of reduction of exacerbation. Looking at the FEV1 in this patient population, I'm showing you here on the left, so that's a net of placebo, 12% improvement of FEV1 in the reversible population and patients not on oral corticosteroids. I would like to mention that even in all comers, we saw significant improvement with FEV1 by tralokinumab, Q2-week W dosing. Pyrosin further enhanced the improvement in the lung function, now 14.7%. Now, if I look at the other secondaries, these are asthma control and quality of life. I mentioned earlier, for asthma control, that's measured by ACQ6, a decrease of 0.5 point is minimally important differences. We saw, even in the reversible population without a biomarker, this point decrease of 0.55, and pyrosin further enhanced it. In terms of quality of life, or increase of 0.5 point is minimally important differences. And in this population, tralokinumab improved the quality of life. I also want to mention that this is where we are different from our competitors. We saw improvement in those control measures, ACQ6 and the quality of life. So put it together, we believe that our phase 2B is very informative. We identify biomarkers who can potentially use to predict response. We identified a patient subgroup. Patient subgroup have improvement across a range of asthma controls. Asthma exacerbation, lung function, asthma control, and quality of life. We believe we can take this population, we can take tralokinumab into phase 3 in this defined population, and phase 3 will confirm the benefit of tralokinumab therapy in the population. So we expect phase 3 to start in the third quarter of this year. The population, as mentioned, is a learning from our phase 2B clinical study. It's going to be reversible population, patients who are not on oral corticosteroids, and stratified by biomarkers. Primary endpoints and secondary endpoints will be the same as in our phase 2B clinical studies. For those patients who are on maintenance oral corticosteroids, we'll do a separate sparing study to see whether tralokinumab will be able to taper steroids use in those patient population and bring benefits to those patients. A third molecular entity This is an anti-TSLP or MEDI9929 MGN157. We're quite excited about this molecule. This is in collaboration with Amgen. The target is a new cytokine called TSLP. Now, this is on slide number 34. TSLP is an upstream cytokine directly produced by epitheliums induced by viruses and allergens. If you look at a pathway on your left, TSLP activates multiple pathways. So it is upstream, it activates multiple pathways. Therefore, this molecule, anti-TSLP, could have the potential for broader population or higher efficacy or potentially for disease modification. So our partner Amgen and their colleagues completed a phase 1b study that's an allergen challenge study. Data is very strong. I'm really happy to share with you this news. It just came out today. The paper describing anti-TSLP was just published today on the New England Journal of Medicine, along with the paper, there's an editorial highlighting the significance of this finding. This is the first anti-TSLP human study, and also the first one to elucidate the function in humans of this new cytokine. The conclusion is that treatment with MGN157, this anti-TSLP antibody, reduced allergen-induced bronchoconstriction and indexes of airway inflammation. I like the quote from the editorial. It says, there is a possibility, the possibility that TSLP could be a master switch between epitheliums and an inflammatory cascade. This molecule now, what we are developing this molecule, is currently in phase 2b clinical study in severe patients. We have patients enrolled, we're actively recruiting the patients. So with that, I would like to bring back to what I stated at the beginning. We have a strong, robust portfolio. We're using personalized healthcare approach, targeting distinct patient population. So those therapies have the potential to transform disease management. I do hope that you appreciate the breadth of our portfolio and share the excitement as we are about our molecules. So with that, I would like to thank you for your attention. I'll hand it back to Colleen.
So as we get ready to take questions from the audience and from the phone, I just want to caveat that tonight we have our respiratory, scientific, and commercial folks here, and we'd like to try to keep the questions focused on that, and we would not like to take questions around the Pfizer situation. So I'll start by saying if you have a question, please state your name, the company that you work for, and then ask your question. And if you're on the phone, please press star one if you want to ask a question. Seamus? Oh, and wait for the microphone if you're in the room.
Thanks. Seamus Fernandez from Leerink Partners. So maybe a question for Bing. You know, you have on this slide up here the overlapping potential groups here. Again, it looks like a Venn diagram of some kind. But can you, you know, in terms of the overlap of Th2-driven disease, eosinophilic disease, it seems like there's considerable overlap. You also saw in the abstract for anti-TSLP an impact on eosinophils as well. So obviously, these are all intrinsically linked. Just wondering how you are working to carve up these different therapies to really get to a more personalized treatment regimen, and how important it is to have all of these targets to be able to do that.
Yeah, sure. That's an area we are working on now to understand the patient overlap and patient subsets for each of our therapies. So what I can tell you is for bevacizumab, so clearly because of MOA, we're going for eosinophilic asthma. Depends on the cutoff, that could be 50% of the total uncontrolled severe asthma. And because we have multiple trials and samples going on, we are in a unique position to have this assets. We were able to characterize, for example, the overlap of the patient population, particularly pyrosinin high and eosinophil high or eosinophil high and low. You use two biomarkers, you can divide the population into four. So there are, as you stated, there are overlaps between eosinophilic asthma and the Th2-driven. But what I can tell you is bamlanivimab has a potential to target 50% of the severe asthma. Combine the two, for example, bamlanivimab and Etrelo, now we can expand that to 70% of the patients, approximately. But because of the TSLP, could also targeting other pathways you saw in that diagram remain to be confirmed, such as IL-17 pathway and mast cell, so potential for a broader population. So with that and others, we have the potential to cover the entire spectrum of the severe asthma space.
Seamus, can I have a quick comment? Which, you know, I think we really are in a unique position in terms of the discovery efforts, the development efforts we have in terms of really understanding which patients are going to most appropriately respond, what's the right sequence in terms of treatment and therapy and staging of therapy, what is the appropriate cutoff and trade-off of cutoffs, for example, between eosinophil, Th2, non-Th2. And we do see, with benralizumab, as Binga said, likely to focus in the higher eosinophil group. At the moment, we believe periostin and potentially DPP-4 could be important for tralokinumab. And TSLP is very exciting. It could have a broad range of efficacy, particularly in Th2, but also potentially in non-Th2. So we are able to specify, and I think that has huge value, both for the clinician, the patient, but also for the payer, in demonstrating the most appropriate value proposition in an increasingly challenging budget environment. Next question.
You guys are too easy.
Another question from Seamus.
Yeah. I can just hold on to the microphone, I guess.
I guess as another question, in one of the COPD sessions, one of the physicians actually stood up and said, we really need to get away from the utilization of steroids in the treatment of COPD. Can you guys comment on that? Because you're making a pretty strong statement with PT010. And I'm just wondering, what is the focus there? Do you really believe that budesonide is differentiated from the other steroids? Because it would seem like that's really the only vehicle that would get us, sort of away from that developing mentality.
Yeah, so thanks for that question. Absolutely, there's a lot of question about the benefit risk of inhaled steroids in COPD versus asthma. And the different studies and different meta-analyses have shown an increased incidence of pneumonia in the population. There was a poster from a meta-analysis of 6 budesonide studies shown yesterday. Actually, I think maybe at that same session, I'm not so sure, showing no increase. So we believe that in the near term, inhaled steroids are absolutely going to have a role in the control of exacerbations in COPD, and that the benefit risk overall of inhaled steroids is still positive, and that for budesonide, it absolutely is positive because the rate, in some analyses you've seen slight increases, in some analyses you've seen none. So we believe that we have a greater benefit on exacerbation than risk on pneumonia.
So let's take a question from the phone next. So we'll go to Alexandra Haber.
Hello. Good evening. I have two questions. On stuff which hasn't been talked about, actually. The last slide, 36, does actually show prodalumab, but I'm not quite sure where it would fit in. I thought it's probably more in the Th2-driven diseases, but no, we're still waiting for the phase 2b result. But just roughly, if you could explain where in the disease paradigm that agent fits. And the second question, since we have Chuck from Pearl here, I just had a question of feasibility, a question on the triple combination. Based on the technology on the drug dispersion in the microparticle, is it just as simple to disperse three molecules as it is two molecules, or is there any sort of complexity to that which you may want to explain? Thank you.
Okay, I can take that first question on brodalumab. So the brodalumab currently is in development for severe asthma. It's in phase 2b development that was led by our partner Amgen. If you look at the MOA of bradamumab, it's blocking IL-17 family of cytokines that include IL-25 and IL-17. IL-25 could potentially be involved in the Th2. IL-17 could be involved in neutrophil migration into the lung. So in terms of where we're going to position the bradamumab in here, it's going to be really dependent on the phase 2b results which are going to come out.
Okay, I'll answer. This is Chuck Bramlage. I'll answer the question about the triple. We're very excited at Pearl to contribute to AZ's future by developing this triple. We will present data, we hope, at ERS that will show the data of what we did last at the end of last year. The term that you asked in the question was, it simple? I can tell you in the industry, it is not simple to put three drugs together in the same canister, but lucky with us, with this technology, we have been able to formulate very quickly. And the whole key to Pearl is the formulation process and what we have here. So we've been able to do what many companies have not in putting these products together. And many of the other companies in the industry outside of AZ who stepped up and acquired us all came asking and wanting our triple formulation technology. And we know that they have issues at doing that. We know that there's issues with two compounds in the same formulation. So what we see with the Pearl technology is a very consistent dosing where the first dose is just like the 120th dose, and the FDA and regulatory bodies will really like to see the CMC data that goes into the application. Very constant dosing. And you do not see that with powders, and you do not see it with the old historical MDIs. What you do see is with Pearl technology, you're going to see that. So again, it opens up all kind of opportunities. Previous comment about having a llama with a LABA, as we're doing now, an ICS with a llama, which we're looking at as well. We've already formulated. So we've got all kind of combinations. And these guys are going to give us some new compounds to put in combinations. So it's very exciting for us to have the investor, the investment coming from AZ to make this happen. Our team is constant. We've been driving. We're going to deliver everything that we set on time. Our combination product is going to be delivered. We finished everything on time. We'll finish. You'll see data in the first quarter of next year. And the triple, we will start next year. So the only thing we're doing right now to work on the triple is working on what is the budesonide dosing. We've done all the other dosing in phase 2, very comprehensive. We need to do the work on budesonide. We've done it, and we're doing it in trials right now, and that's where the phase 2 is. So the term simple, I want to challenge a little bit, but we are able to do this, and we're very excited then to have this technology reach patients because we've got a good marketing arm in AZ. So very excited about this.
And if I can just build on that briefly, Alexander, I think, we are able to move quickly. We've demonstrated that. That's why I made the point earlier. We had not formulated and co-formulated with budesonide last year, and we did in the second half of last year, and that allowed us to move quickly into phase 1 and complete phase 1. It's this consistency and predictability which is being replicated in phase 1 and now being replicated in phase 2, which is by far from simple. But that's giving us a greater deal of confidence. We're putting together known molecules. We know their activity and their profiles. We know with the Pearl technology, we have predictability in dosing and dose confirmation and the delivery, which gives us confidence in terms of both the phase 3 program, but also importantly from a regulatory process. And we know that is a challenge for many regulatory authorities in demonstrating that dosing and dosing consistency. And that's why I think, we are particularly pleased with the balance of our portfolio. We have a series of novel, innovative, what we believe is best potential to be best-in-class novel therapies and or even first-in-class approaches like the TSLP. And we are the first product to show with benralizumab in COPD phase 2b efficacy across a range of parameters. But also we've got a portfolio where we've got a balanced risk based on a strong technology platform with known assets, which are potentially moving into very big classes for the future in the shape of the LABA LAMA and also the LABA LAMA ICS, both in asthma and also in COPD. That's why I came back and I wanted to just reinforce that message on it's a combination in our strategy of firstly molecules, great molecules, secondly great combinations, and especially giving us the combinations of the Pearl platform, and then finally device technology and device differentiation. I'll just reiterate, you know, the Pearl technology will allow us to be the first metered-dose inhaler, which we know is important for a number of patients and obviously for physicians in providing choice. And that ranges between 25 and 35% typically of patients being treated on that formulation.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure whether I'm still on. I just, first, apologies for using the term simple. Maybe I should have more, what I'm really after is that I do understand the importance of the dose uniformity or dose homogeneous dosing. But once you have shown that you can do this with two molecules, because once the stuff is dispersed in the microparticles, does that de-risk the triple? Because, I mean, if you can disperse two, then there's no reason why you couldn't disperse three, unless you tell me there is a reason you can't, because there is anything specific about the budesonide molecule in terms of, you know, let's say lipophilic properties or anything. So the question is it correct to assume that if you can do it with two, you can probably also do it with three?
Correct.
Some dosing studies?
Correct. Yes, we can, and we already have. And you'll see the data, but we have no problem at all with the formulation. We're moving forward.
And we're also interested, Alexander, in looking at beyond three.
Yes.
Okay.
You want to go for four?
Thank you very much.
Over here. I'm Alex Teo from Cross Current Research. In this conference, we started to see some data that demonstrate even in the more severe patients, COPD patients, that you can use LAMA-LABA that's no worse than ICS or equivalent in the patients who are not experiencing recent exacerbations. And am I correct to assume in the very severe end of the spectrum, the patients who have a lot of exacerbations, the future lies has to be a triple, or the ICS LABA is at the end of its usage?
So I think in the if you think about you know a lot of the quadrants they showed you in a lot of those presentations this week, you're talking about that upper quadrant of very severe who are exacerbating as well. And so I think that those people need both maximal bronchodilation and control of exacerbations. And that's so that's a path that generally will lead to a triple, we believe.
I'd add, though, I mean, we believe, and I showed in my slide earlier on in terms of the grids, we do see a very significant opportunity for the more symptomatic patient, the milder, a moderate symptomatic patient for the LABA-LAMA, and that's why we're excited to move forward with the MDI formulation of the LABA-LAMA with Pearl. We do also see, before we reach fixed combinations of the triple therapy, there will be a role to add in an ICS or for a LABA ICS, and of course we believe we have a very good one of those. And then ultimately, of course, moving forward with the triple therapy, providing a fixed dose convenience for those patients who are continuing to have demonstrations of exacerbations. So we are, as I said, covering the whole range of portfolio in terms of symptoms and also those patients who've got more frequent exacerbations where you add in the ICS.
So you also have a MABA program. where does that fit? And can you give us an update on it?
Yeah, so the MABA program has always been seen as a platform to handle co-formulations and actually get control of the bronchodilator part of it. And in that context, it's currently treated. So the MABA will always benefit from combinations to triples to quadruples. And in that context, we looked at the opportunity in this moment, put it in the Pearl platform to simply take it from there onwards as a basis for further co-formulations. Which brings me also back to the question you had on you have to realize severe COPD is at this moment mainly addressed by bronchodilation, which is symptomatic control from day to day, very relevant for if you're breathlessness. But the ICS component, as we all know in steroid, has a pluriformity of reactions. Some of it is understood, some of it not is understood. And underneath, way deeper in what we usually show on our pipeline, there is a tremendous effort. And I think benralizumab in COPD is actually the first announcement. We really want to start attacking the disease modification arm of COPD. And in that way, you can just, but besides signs and symptoms control, also try to attack preservation of lung, and in that way simply either prevent progression, or maybe even in the far future, bend the curve backwards. And that's where the MABA sits in, mainly as a platform for those compounds as far as they will be inhaled.
Yeah, and I'd also say, just being purely pragmatic, you know, we have a DPI, an MDI formulation with the Pearl platform. We have the potential with a DPI, obviously, with the MABA. So it gives us another option for it, the equivalent of a LABA-LAMA DPI. So we would have both the opportunities to deliver both types of formulation with the MABA on its own, or as Martin says, as a backbone platform for other combinations.
Sarah?
Sarah Potter from Bank of America. I notice on your slide that the triple isn't scheduled to launch until 2020. I wondered if you could run through kind of what takes 4 years or so from a trial design perspective, and how we should think about a trial design for a triple, given none of your combinations are currently approved, so from an FDA perspective.
Okay. First off, we have, like I mentioned, we have to look at budesonide. We have to create the dose on budesonide. What does that look like first? We have a series of meeting with all the regulatory bodies. So this is a questionable thing for every company that's going to try this, right? I mean, so we're trying to find out, does this combination along compare with this one compared to this one, and then what does the triple look like? So we are effectively showing that with our LABA-LAMA against the singles. We will have to do with budesonide, and then we're looking at budesonide in, that is a Pearl Symbicort, which we've already developed. So we have to show that combination and what that looks like, and then the triple. If you take a look, and we, right now, we believe 2020 is a great time for us to get that approved. We're trying to work ways to push that into 2019. Colin Reisner, I would like him to say some things. Colin is our chief medical officer. He's sitting right here in the front. And if we could give him a microphone, I'd like for him to comment on this as well. But there are, again, looking at shortcuts or things that we're trying to do with the regulatory bodies to bring this to patients faster. We're trying to do that. We know that in the other companies that are competing with us, the real issue is the formulation. That's not a problem with us. So our issue is doing the data as quick as we can, the trials that the regulatory groups want. And frankly, we've had several meetings with them already, and they're trying to help us find a way to make this work. But Colin, take the floor.
Sure. Thank you. Just by way of background, we began our first clinical trial in November of 2008. And by December of 2012, we had had our end of phase two meeting with the FDA, EMA, and Health Canada. We had completed 10 clinical studies in over 1,000 patients to fully characterize the dose selection for glycopyrrolate, formoterol, and the combination of the two. We went from a company that was essentially a phase two company in December of 2012 to our phase three program, which we began in May, beginning June of last year. There were two large pivotal studies known as Pinnacle 1 and Pinnacle 2, as well as an extension study, Pinnacle 3. The two pivotal studies enrolled over 3,100 patients. We completed enrollment last week, and the extension study has also completed its enrollment. So, as Chuck had mentioned, those timelines that we have put down, we believe are realistic, but maybe somewhat conservative, and we would plan to see what we can do to improve on those. Thank you.
Just as a follow-up to Bing, would you run through again the inclusion criteria that you mentioned for the phase three Benra and Trala programs? I think you mentioned high eosinophils for Benra. Is that a specific inclusion criteria, or are you all comers and then just subtyping?
Yeah, I can comment that first, then Bill, you can comment on that too. So it's going to be the major population for phase three. Clearly, it's going to be eosinophilic patient population. We pre-specified a cutoff that's based on our phase 2B data, but we will have the ability to test a range of different eosinophils for different subgroups.
So it's all the trial.
We're investigating the spectrum
of patients with the eosinophils. Yeah. But we do, as Bing said, we'll have an analysis looking at different cuts to find the pre-specified analysis.
I'm going to go next to the phone to Steve Scala.
Well, thank you. I have two questions, please. First, what are the dose-limiting toxicities of the anti-TSLP mechanism? And secondly, what do you see as the specific weaknesses in competitive products such as the marketed LABA LAMAs and the triples that are in development that AstraZeneca is improving upon? Thank you.
So Steve, I just want to make sure I understand your question. It's talking about dose limiting toxicity of TSLP. I think so far we have seen in preclinical and clinical studies, we have not observed any significant toxicity. The drug appears to have an acceptable profile in our phase 1b clinical study. I'm not aware of any tox finding in preclinical studies. I have a project leader here, so Jenny, do you have anything to add to that?
Can you repeat your second question you had?
I've got it. So the question on the second one is about LABA LAMAs, and what is AZ looking at in terms of the competitive disadvantages or the things that we would provide that the other competitors don't? I think the number one thing without a doubt is the MDI, the fact that we're going to provide a different device. I don't know how many COPD patients you know, but I have one close in my family who was having a hard time with a dry powder device, and I happened to know this person. I said, you're going to have to get something else. You need a certain inspiratory flow to get the drug out. And once that patient was switched to an MDI device, had no problem. Again, the device was activated and they could take the drug. So I think that's number one. Number two, maybe it's number one, is the fact that we're going to be dosed twice a day. And if you look at COPD patients, they have problems breathing in the morning and evening in particular. And if you take a look at our dose curve, they're going to have the 12-hour dose curve and then a second dose curve applied. Compare that to someone on a 24-hour product. They are going to have declines in the second half of the day, and that's where I think our benefit will be. Take also the fact that when that happens, someone on the managed care side, these patients are going to start taking a once-a-day medicine twice, and you're going to see managed care or governments getting very upset about that. So I think from those two elements are the two biggest things that we offer to our patients with our LAMA LABA.
Can I just build on the triple? Because I think the question was also related to the triple. And I think first and foremost, as we've seen in a number of the competitors, this is a complex area. And I go back to the reply we gave to Alexandra. We have great confidence in the consistency and reliability of the Pearl platform, but it is far from simple. And making sure you're getting dual combination therapy data demonstrated to the regulatory authorities is not straightforward, as we've seen. And we have great confidence in the way in which we can demonstrate that dose conformity and delivery with the Pearl platform, both for the LABA LAMA and also for the triple. And that's a key to thinking about what we think about as our probability of success of this potentially very significant portfolio. The second one is budesonide. You know, I think it is important. I come back to Bill's point. Yeah. You know, the profile of budesonide, we believe, very well explored, very well researched, is somewhat different from other steroids, and that's, you know, documented and labeled as well. So I don't think we should underestimate that we have confidence in the MDI, we have confidence in the twice daily, we have confidence in the combination consistency, and also, as I said right at the beginning, the fundamentals of the right molecules in the first place.
And to give some, because the scientist likes to speak out as well, to give the detail on the triple is especially controlling your local drug-to-drug interactions within your formulation is a significant task. And because of the pills, so spatially keep them apart, that's something where I think apart from the complexity of co-formulation, actually finding the dose that also is, I think, a major upside where the pill formulation allows us simply not to worry about local drug-drug interactions in your formulation and stability over time.
So let's...
I think there was a question with Seamus, right?
Yeah, thank you. Seamus.
Thanks. Seamus Fernandez, Leerink Partners. So I guess a couple of questions for Bing. Can you walk us through the story for tralokinumab in IPF a little bit more, particularly in the context of some of the data that we saw for the oral agents and your interest or the prospect of seeing an IL-13 actually potentially combined with those options? And then separately, maybe you can speak a little bit more broadly. I tried to ask this question once before, I think, on the first quarter conference call, but got not a complete answer, so I'm going to ask it again. The opportunities to basically see the mechanisms that we are looking at in respiratory expand into other areas, as we've seen the TNFs expand into multiple other disease areas, atopic dermatitis, other areas. Where do you see the other opportunities for this portfolio outside of respiratory?
So I'm going to answer your first question first, then hand to Bill to add to it, then we'll come back to your second question. See, in terms of IL-13 for IPF, so we collaborated extensively with our investigators to build a scientific rationale for IL-13 in IPF. So there's a lot of data built on that. One of the major mechanisms for IL-13 in fibrosis is the induction of the fibroblast proliferation and fibrosis. We have preclinical models, tested our compounds in those models, demonstrating efficacy in preclinical models. More importantly, in patients, if we just go IPF patients and look at the biomarkers, we found subsets of patients have elevated interleukin 13, so in their peripheral blood, and also other biomarkers such as periostin. So that's really have a scientific rationale for going into IPF with anti-IL-13 mechanism. So we started phase 2 clinical study, I believe, last year, and the trial currently is actively recruiting, is ongoing. So So Bill, you want to add about the oral?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, as a former practicing pulmonologist, it is exciting that they had some positive data finally in IPF. It's a very miserable disease. And actually the lead authors on the one paper are former colleagues of mine, so it's exciting. But still, 75% of the patients did progress or die. And so it's not like we've obliterated disease or gotten rid of all the unmet need there. I think there are two agents that have shown some efficacy. They both have substantial side effects. I think they'll be hard to challenge to combine together because of the GI toxicity, but maybe, we'll see. But I think an additional therapy will still be needed to really bend that curve.
So getting back to your second question, are we pursuing other opportunities with the current respiratory molecules? We did not get a chance to talk about other portfolio, inflammation, autoimmunity. One of our strategy for those inflammation autoimmunity is to understand the shared pathway. You go into one indication, then you expand. You give a really good example of anti-TNF, goes to RA first, expanding into all the other indications, PSA, AS, and UC, Crohn's, et cetera. That's how they build the franchise. So for respiratory, that's no different. For example, in the case of bevacizumab, you can imagine we have an antibody that can deplete eosinophils. Any disease, eosinophil plays a major role. In theory, you can pursue that. That's exactly what we did with COPD. And also we have other investigators approached us for investigator-sponsored study. So we are actively evaluating other opportunities for bevacizumab, so as a part of the life cycle plan. For tralokinumab, you mentioned we did, for example, IPF. It's an extension of this mechanism. That's based on the science, based on our understanding of the disease. I understand that dupilumab had a data published for atopic dermatitis, and that's an illustration of the Th2 pathway in atopic derm. So we are also evaluating our molecule for other indications, so where the IL-13 pathway is active. So it's an active evaluation. When we start the trial, we'll be announcing those.
And Seamus, can I give a more philosophical perspective as well? Because I've been in the middle, I was in the middle of the Remicade franchise, when both on the academical side and the industry side, when we actually went through the journey and find out in some diseases, completely unexpected, there was an overlap. But as you know, if you won't the story, there were also other diseases where we tested it, where we didn't find the overlap. So like Bing said, is we of course will look at the opportunity and always try to follow the biology and not put too much focus on the core area. But on the other hand, we learned from all the journeys in the other diseases that it's not that easy. And there are some examples where the drug actually works in the hands of clinicians, and as a company, you can't reproduce it in a controlled trial simply because of the complexity of the disease or the symptoms complex, which is aggregated as a disease. So there's always will be, I think, the opportunity is there, is flagged, but to pursue it is not as easy as sometimes it's thought when you go backwards.
Any other last questions?
Can I just ask one last one? it's a little bit of a surprise question, but we learned yesterday at an FDA presentation that there has been a drug apparently filed for breakthrough designation in lupus. Is it your drug?
We would be saying, we'd be disclosing if we had a significant breakthrough status at this stage. So, we're progressing with our phase two data analysis of sifalimumab, and we're progressing with our phase two program with anifrolumab as well.
Thank you.
Very good. With that, I guess, unless there's any last questions, I'll just wrap up and summarize. As I said in my introductory comments, respiratory autoimmune is one of the chosen areas for focus, one of three key areas for establishing AstraZeneca's return to growth, embedded with scientific leadership. And I think you can see why. We have a very strong existing portfolio, and we're investing further to differentiate what we believe are strong brands in Pulmicort and in Symbicort. We have a very strong inhaled future franchise, and I hope we've demonstrated that in the confidence we have with the LABA/LAMA and also with the triple. And we've got emerging, very exciting data with our biologics portfolio, which is now moving forward towards phase three for tralokinumab, in phase three for benralizumab in asthma, and moving towards phase three with COPD. And in addition to that, we're also seeing with the New England Journal very exciting new data for a potential first-in-class with a very novel mode of action with TSLP. Obviously, there's a long way to go there in terms of further data and analysis, but with that range of portfolio, and in particular that understanding of the multiple biologics pathways, we think we've got a very good opportunity to truly lead and make a difference to patients' lives, help clinicians, and also demonstrate real value to payers. And with that, I'd like to close the session today. Thanks, Colleen. Thank you all for attending. Thanks for listening on the line.